You know, when it comes to wireless carriers, sometimes what you see isn't always what you get, except with Visible. With Visible, what you see is exactly what you get. If you haven't heard of Visible, well, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. With Visible, there are no hidden fees, no fine print, no hassle, nothing to hide. It's just $25 a month, all taxes and fees included. And you don't need more than one line of wireless to save. You can save on a line all to yourself with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. And again, just $25 a month. The future of wireless is here, and it is transparent. If you want more transparency in your wireless plan, you want to be on the Visible plan. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. That's Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. This episode of GameScoop is sponsored by Squarespace. If you're looking for a way to make your business stand out and succeed online, Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for you. They take the stress out of creating an awesome website, engaging with your audience, and selling anything from products to content to time, so you're able to focus on, you know, everything else. In other words, you'll have more time for gaming. With the new guided design system, you can choose from curated layouts and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, optimized for every device. And with Squarespace's integrated, optimized SEO tools, you'll show up more often to more people. Squarespace doesn't just make things easier for you. Checkout for your customers is made seamless with simple but powerful payment tools that allow you to accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and Clearpay. So whether you're just starting out or looking to expand your existing brand, be sure to visit squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/gamescoop to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/gamescoop for 10% off. Come get up. See where
I live. IGN GameScoop.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to IGN GameScoop. I'm your host, Damon Hatfield. Joining me this week is Vincent Genito.
Heyo!
Brandon Tyrell.
Hello.
And making his first Scoop appearance, Jonathan Dornbush.
Hello.
Welcome Scoops!
If you don't know him, he's one of our news writers. He works for Andrew Goldfarb. He's an all-around cool dude. Thanks for coming by the show.
Thank you for having me.
We got a great show for you this week. We're going to talk about Deus Ex. It's a subject I know Vince cares about, at least.
Yes.
We're going to talk about, apparently, BioWare has a new game coming out in the not-too-distant future. But first, we got an email from one of our listeners, Joe W. He emailed us at the email address.
GameScoop@IGN.com,
just like you can. And he says, I'm curious, how much AAA games should really cost? Allow me to explain. I walk into a GameStop and I want to buy Mass Effect Andromeda. It's $60. Assuming GameStop is making money on every game sold, how much are they paying EA per unit, and how much are they making in profit? Now I open up Origin on my PC. I want to buy Mass Effect Andromeda. It's $60. Why? If I'm buying right from the publisher, why am I paying the same amount that I would pay to a third party? Or I go to Amazon. I want to buy Mass Effect Andromeda. I have Amazon Prime, so it's $48. Assuming Amazon still wants to make a profit on each unit sold, how much are they paying EA per unit and how much are they making in profit? It seems to me that AAA games are $60 because they just are. There just seems to be no rhyme or reason to it. Whether you're buying from a distributor or right from the publisher, it's the same price. It doesn't make sense to me.
So the place this question has to go to is the publisher. That's where the money is in this industry. Like this whole triangle of like the retailer and the developer and the publisher, and everyone's like, where does all the money go? Who has it? The publisher has it. Like, that's the answer. Like, I remember I used to work at GameStop back when they were Electronics Boutique, and I think it was Diablo 2 was the moment where I realized this, where my manager clued me into what was going on, that if someone bought a copy of Diablo 2, which was $49.99 at the time, which was the standard price for games then, if they bought a copy of Diablo 2 new with an American Express, that little extra merchant's fee tacked on by American Express actually made our total financial outlook on that purchase a loss. We were actually losing money on the sale of that new game. And on game, and if it wasn't by Amex, then we were probably making $2 per unit, which is why, of course, GameStop focuses so much on pre-owned.
On new stuff.
Profit margins for brick and mortar are like
horrible. I understand it differently. I understand on a $60 game bought at a retailer, about half goes to the publisher and about 25% goes to the retailer.
That's how I understand it.
Maybe it's changed since.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, I haven't been in games retail in 10 years now, so it's possible it's changed. Yeah.
Well, the $60 price has been the standard for about 10 years now.
Yeah. I exited
since
right around
the start of the 360.
Yeah, I exited right after the 360.
Well, and
launch.
Speaking to the question, it was talking about the difference between online and in store. While stores still, obviously, digital sales are rising. We've seen that as year over year, but stores still make up in store purchases, still make up a huge.
Walmart,
a huge amount of it, and so it wouldn't make sense for a direct publisher or a marketplace like the Sony Marketplace to sell at a huge loss compared to that, because if they're selling their game for $40, obviously players are going to go there instead of the store. They don't want to anger those stores. Okay. Just
so it's a relationship.
I think at least part of that is still a relationship play in terms of why they're still 60 versus 60 online versus in store.
So yesterday, EA released their financials. Mm-hmm. Yes. I don't know what quarter it was, but the recent financials for the holiday
Q3.
Season.
Q3.
And I think they said that 60% of their revenues came from digital.
Right. Yeah.
So a little more than half
is
coming from
rising.
Digital, but still 40% of their business is at retailer. So you're saying they are not going to charge less on Origin because that relationship with retail is still too valuable.
I think it's an important relationship play to maintain for sure,
at least
for the time being.
It's a little less than half their business.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, there is also businesses are going to charge the absolute maximum that they can, no matter what their product is, right? And I think they just sort of also assume that people are used to paying $60 for a new game, so that's what they charge.
Yeah. Unless you're Amazon and you're trying to make sure that people come to your site to buy from you no matter what. And that's what the price on Amazon is all about. It's not, you know, when our reader, our viewer is saying, you know, that Amazon, you assume, wants to make a profit on it. They don't care at all. They don't need to make a profit on video games. They'd be very happy, a company like that has so much reach and is in so many different markets where the price, like, so for instance, if you sell, I don't know, does Amazon sell clothes?
Yes.
They do. Okay. So I have no idea. But
anything, they sell everything.
Yeah. That's what I kind of assume, right? But like, let's take something like clothes or something like stereo equipment. The markup on those is like 300%.
Sure.
So it's like, if they're selling stereo equipment at a 300% markup,
it's out.
They can totally afford to take a hit on games just to make sure someone buys from them instead of their competitors. Yeah. And then that person buys theoretically
conversion rates. Yeah.
And you're seeing game sales happen more and more sooner after the game comes out. You're seeing games go down to $30 all the time, much faster than it used to.
Yeah. Plus, with a situation like on Amazon, that Amazon Prime discount is something that the consumer is already paying for.
Yes.
Sure. Like a PlayStation Plus game or Xbox games with gold. Like,
it's recouped somewhat through the...
You've subsidized the whole system with your Amazon Prime subscription, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, Amazon's got more money than they sort of know what... As an entity, it knows what to do with.
Right.
So it's very reminiscent of like Microsoft selling 360s at a loss, you know, for the first couple of years of that console just to get market share. If Amazon can sort of tilt the scales and make, you know, anybody with an online connection go to Amazon versus driving to Walmart, right? Like, that's more business that they get, like you said, and then converting. So it makes sense.
Yeah. Well, we were saying that $60 retail, you know, price on launch day is almost like a median price now when you consider that how quickly games are discounted now, as you say. Yeah. But then also, special editions of games are $80, $100, plus all of the, like, the season pass, all of the DLC, all that bumps up the cost really above $60. Oh, so I really think of today's $60 as like the medium price of video games.
Yeah,
almost.
Well, and especially when you still have digital games going for around $20 usually, there is a variation in price.
You mean like indie, like smaller
stuff? Yeah, for smaller stuff as well. But that $60 price isn't really the whole picture anymore.
Mm. Yeah, and especially now as we see different games of all different sizes taking that price tag, and it bears like the question from the consumer very often, you know, what is $60 worth of value? But like, I don't think there's a hard and fast answer to that, which is why no one can really figure it out. Like, that's why you still see, that's why you can go, you know, to a store, you can buy two games that are $60. One of them could be, and I'm not saying this is a matter of value to me, but one could be 8 hours and another could be 200 hours, and they occupy that same kind of space. Is that right? Is that wrong? I don't know, but like, to some people, that's a problem.
Well, it used to, way back in the day when games were on cartridges, there was no like standardized format. You'd go and look, you'd go to like KB Toys and look at the Nintendo games, and they were like all different prices, like $34, $54.
And then memory was so expensive back then. Yeah. So like, if you were buying a larger game that had more on the cart, I mean, I remember, you know, I think it was Phantasy Star 2 for the Genesis was one of the first first 6 meg carts instead of a 4 meg one. That was like $80.
Yeah. Those games, you know. Beyond Oasis and Shining Force 2, I think was a really
Shining
expensive
in the
cart.
Darkness, yeah.
It's just like, there was no standardization of prices back
then.
Yeah.
Let me ask you guys this. Yeah. With the Nintendo Switch coming out, I'm getting a Switch, I'm excited for it, but we know it's just not as powerful as an Xbox One or PlayStation 4. So what do you guys think about, again, the games are $60, same as a PlayStation 4 game, same as an Xbox One game?
I mean, it brings it back to Vince's point, right? Like, where do you put value? Do you put value in the visuals? Do you put value in how much content comes there? I mean, it's a big reason we don't really put much weight on the price of a game when it factors into reviews, right? Or how long it is. It stands on its own merits. And so what you want from a game is different from what I want from a game. So if I think 1-2 Switch is worth $60 and you don't, like, you know, that's a decision that we make amongst ourselves. So I don't fault Nintendo for selling at the standardized price now, even though, I mean, we're coming into this generation knowing that, I'm sorry, we're coming into this console knowing that it's not sort of generation standard as far as power goes.
Yeah.
I'm already pre-ordered a Switch. I'm looking forward to Zelda. I'm looking forward to 1-2 Switch with my friends in the living room. And, you know, to me, those are both worth $60.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I think they are exploring some variable pricing. I believe it might have changed since they announced it and pre-orders went on sale, but 1-2 Switch was only $50 at that time.
Oh, yeah.
But Zelda's
it's a bargain.
$60. Well, it's just, I think they're exploring, whereas I think something like Snipper Clips is even cheaper. So I think they're looking. That game looks really fun.
That looks awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. But so they're clearly looking to see what the marketplace is willing to spend on something that's so different.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And that's like what it's always going to come down to the free market, right? Like, I hate saying that, but it's going to be, you know, we'll know what the price of a game's, what the average price of a game is supposed to be based on whether or not the people go and pick it up. And something tells me that $50 for something like 1-2 Switch, you know, maybe you get the casual kind of like, you know, dad wants something cool and distracting for their family when people come over. Fine. Like, those people might spend $50 on that, not knowing what it is or not caring.
Sure.
But I don't think you're going to convince millions and millions of people that that's the killer app that you need to spend $50.
No, but there's a difference between the killer app and just like standardized pricing for something that, you know, they are releasing. Like, what was Wii Sports priced at when it first came out?
That's a great question.
Okay. So it's packed in, so you didn't even have to pay for it.
Which came with the, I believe it was, Wii Play with the controller came. Mm-hmm. I think that was $50.
Okay. Similar. I mean, not inflated for, you know, time, but I think you don't really have to necessarily convince people to buy your system based on like 1-2 Switch or a piece of software. I think, pricing shouldn't be indicative of that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I just think that it's because of, especially with mobile gaming becoming such a big deal and the race to the bottom and all that, like we always talk about on the show. Whether we like it or not, I think that there's no changing the growing perspective that number of hours and price needs to be somehow
some correlation there.
There needs to be some correlation there. And I don't personally believe that. I think that's actually a harmful assertion to make. Yeah. But I feel like the seed has been planted and there's no going back now. And I think eventually developers are going to be in a position where if their game is short or doesn't have tons of modes and maps and stuff, they're almost not going to have a choice if they want to compete but to lower their prices. But I don't want to see that happen.
Look at it from the opposite perspective, right? Like, there's, in line with that, there's almost this perception of price dictates quality. So if I think my game, you know, is deserving of a $40 price tag, and I think it'd be doing a service to my consumers to sell it at $40. What's the perception then about how it stacks up to a game that is $60?
That happened with ReCore.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like, they priced it a little bit more modestly, and people were like, oh, it's shovelware.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, the mid-range.
And it turned out to be kind of an average game anyway.
But then you see something
God, it's all true.
The perception was there way before the game was released.
Yeah. Well, and that happened with Ratchet & Clank. That was at $40 when it released, and that was, the perception was, oh no, this is going
to
be sort of a budget Ratchet & Clank.
Yeah.
Another rebooting. Reality
couldn't be anything.
And it was one of my favorite games
of
that year, and I think a lot of people genuinely love that game. It's
totally, yeah. So we're at a point now where price is basically another marketing tool, right?
Yeah.
Like, what the price of your game says about your game is as important as the marketing that you push out. Because they could have dropped as much marketing as they wanted to about ReCore, but like, that price point is what NeoGAF grabbed onto and what Reddit grabbed onto. Mm-hmm. And then it, like No Man's Sky, like, it just sort of proliferates throughout the community.
Yeah, that's true. All right, moving on. We got some unfortunate news this week about the future of the Deus Ex franchise, or even if there will be a future.
Don't say that.
No, I know. So, like, last August, we got Deus Ex Mankind Divided.
Yes.
You reviewed it. You liked it very much.
Yes, I did.
I liked it very much. Did everyone play it here?
No, I dabbled in it, but I was reviewing something.
Yeah, I played a little bit of it, but I enjoyed what I did.
Yeah, I finished the game, and I talked about this on the show before. I was enjoying that game, and then I came to the first boss fight, and then I beat the first boss, and I was like, oh, that was the end of Act 1. But then, nope, the credits rolled. So it's like a cool game that felt unfinished. Mm. And now we get word this week that apparently the developer Eidos is working on the next Tomb Raider game instead of the next Deus Ex, and they also have this deal with Square Enix to work on Marvel games, and the Deus Ex series is being put on hiatus.
Which is really sad because... Yeah. You know, so about Mankind Divided and the story, I just want to be clear, and I think you could probably agree with this too, is that it seemed abrupt the way it ended, but it wasn't. It didn't seem abrupt because the game had been so short. You know, in terms of the time, amount of time, the play time, the amount of time you spent playing the game, and the amount of, you know, what kind of real estate there is there to play around in, was totally comparable to Human Revolution. The difference was is that in terms of the story, the story was much more zoomed in to one event. You know, I don't want to, you know, spoil anyone, but like basically what happens at the beginning of the game is what you focus in on the whole time. And so, and there's a specific reason for that, because it felt like the end of chapter one, because Eidos Montreal when I went there to preview Mankind Divided, the head of the studio told me that they had Deus Ex games planned out to 2025.
So what happened to all those plans?
So yeah,
that's just being shelved.
Obviously it has to do with the fact that Deus Ex didn't perform to their.
Yeah, like we don't have exact sales numbers, but the week or the month that it was out, it was number 3 on MPD. So it actually it must have done fairly well at launch. Yeah. You
know. What was it? Was it August?
I think it was August or September. It was later last summer.
Yeah, around there. Yep. Yeah.
So I mean, what is
before the October crush of games?
Yeah. Does that say more about the month though, or the quality of the game?
I don't know. I also.
It wasn't like it didn't have a lot of competition around that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I think the thing is that games. There's also games similar to it that do things in a way that's a little bit more
Dishonored.
Yeah, sure. Dishonored is a great example of a game that does the similar kinds of things where it's melding stealth and action and kind of RPG style choice in this really fluid kind of organic way. Like Dishonored is way more like, I feel like, a player's game. Mm. It's a go and do and learn by doing. And I feel like Deus Ex is like, you have to have methodical understanding of your environment and of the gameplay systems. And if you don't, then it can feel really bad. Like if you play Deus Ex as a shooter, I mean, I would say Mankind Divided feels better than Human Revolution did, but it's still, for the most part, if you're comparing the two by how things feel when things go wrong, it feels a lot more fun to play Dishonored when things go wrong than when when things go wrong in Deus Ex. And the thing is that with modern stealth games, especially in like the perspective that they play in, things always inevitably go wrong. Like you don't have a top-down perspective to see what's happening around you. So I think like that chaos breaks out, then Deus Ex feels like a pseudo passable, decent shooter, and Dishonored 2, you feel like you're a badass, like you know. Human slaying god, basically, and people like that experience more. So I just feel like it's an easier Dishonored 2 is an easier sell and kind of has more momentum. I don't know.
Yeah, but Deus Ex has a longer history. You know, going back to what, around 2000, the first Deus Ex.
Yeah, 99 or 2000 when the first one comes out. Yeah, I mean, but that's old man games, Damon. You know that.
That's us.
that's us.
I know I give Mankind Divided a hard time for feeling unfinished, but I totally had fun with that game. But when I compare it to something like Uncharted 4, that feels like this huge, big, complete adventure with a beginning, a middle, and an end, even an epilogue tacked on. When I compare it to something like that, you know, I just felt like I was in the middle of Mankind Divided and it just ended. So that wouldn't bother me as much if I knew I was going to continue that story in a year or two. But now it's like,
I think it means it's on hold because they really only officially were talking about the Avengers and other Marvel projects they have going on. So I'm sure at some point they will look into returning to Deus Ex. I know they haven't really officially been talking about the next Tomb Raider game yet either. So it depends where they're going to end up putting their resources.
But totally makes sense. Like with Infinity War coming up, like you definitely want to have your resources making a game that they know is going to sell just on the name alone, right? Rather than, like you said, as much as you'd love to see it or we'd love to see it, like you have a small window to capitalize on a new Avengers movie coming out. So like, sure. It makes sense to put things on hold and prioritize.
It's also a marketing play too. Like, I mean, at the end of the day, like, look, I know I'm one of the few people I think who actually liked the character of Adam Jensen, but I feel like it's cool. Yeah. I think I like him and I kind of like his understated, gruff, like almost removed and not actually that human or demonstrably emotional, like, demeanor. I kind of like that about him. I think it's interesting and not the same as every other kind of wisecracking hero. Mm. But the
also very long arms.
Also very long arms.
Yeah. Good wingspan.
But the wisecracking hero is kind of what sells. Like, just from a marketing standpoint, you let someone watch 30 seconds of, you know, Nathan Drake talking versus Adam Jensen, and there's one game you want to play, one guy you want to spend lots of hours with. So yeah. I think that has a role in it too. It's just hard to market, I think, a character like Adam Jensen to a modern audience.
Yeah, and the Avengers has 6 wisecracking heroes.
Exactly.
So that's easier to market.
One of whom is always angry.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it totally goes back to, do you remember the big, 2014? Like, some like 8 out of 10 of the year's big AAA titles had a white guy walking towards the camera with a buzzed head.
The Bioshock Infinite year.
Bioshock, and there was a Mass Effect. Mass Effect 3.
Bioshock 2012. Maybe 13.
I have no idea when years anything happened.
Yeah, exactly. So games came out then, and a lot of the box arts had the same guy on it. And it totally makes sense. Like, you see that, and you see something that it's not clearly as defined and clearly as tested as that. And it's hard to make that sell, right? Like, I know what I'm getting when I see the Battlefield soldier walk towards me, you know? Like, I'm going to get to be that guy. But I see Adam Jensen right there, and I assume we're going to shoot people, but I'm not 100%. Not 100%.
You don't have to shoot people.
It's true.
That's the beauty of Deus Ex.
Also, he looks like a sad boy, and people just don't give sad boys a chance.
It's just like, I feel like we're going to have to talk about what's bothering him. And like, I don't
probably
know.
Probably all the cybernetics.
Just no one has time for that.
All right, moving on. We mentioned EA's financial report, which came out this week. Yep. And during that call, EA talked about a new IP intellectual property.
Thank you, David. Thank you.
Coming from BioWare before March of 2018.
Yes.
So actually not that far off.
So awesome.
Yeah. And they described this new game as a clean sheet design with new concepts, new gameplay mechanics, and new stories set in a unique new universe.
I'm waiting for the last part.
This game has the potential to fundamentally disrupt the way people think about an action title.
Whoa.
Bringing friends together to play in exhilarating new ways.
Whoa.
We're very excited about the future of this new franchise and its ability to attract a large global audience.
Marketing.
And then BioWare chimed in. This is actually BioWare's blog writing in here to say, in 2012, we began crafting a new universe full of new characters, stories, and games.
5 years.
Yeah.
Our ambition is simple. Draw upon 20-plus years of development, knowledge, and lessons to create something fun and new for you to enjoy with your friends.
Is that all?
Simple.
There's nothing quite as exciting as building a new IP from scratch, and it will be even more thrilling for us to share more with you in the future. Mm. What do we make of all that?
They sure are making a video game in 2017.
Wow. That's a game for sure. I mean, right off the bat, March, you know, coming out February, March, totally not surprising for new IP, right? Like, you're not going to put that up against the fall. The other, I think there was a line in there that said something along the lines of like cross genre or something like that.
Genre melding was in
redefining. And the very first thing that comes to mind when I think of that is one, Destiny, and two, Overwatch.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I agree with that. But do you think, when you think of Destiny and Overwatch, do you think BioWare?
That's the thing, right? Like, it's not an RPG. And when I think BioWare, I think RPG. So I don't know. Like, I'm totally off script right now. Like, I have no idea where we are.
Heavy story focus and character building. Yeah. To make something that massive.
You could argue that, Activision thinks Destiny is very heavy story focus narrative, right? None of it happens inside the game.
No. Well, and I mean, same with Overwatch. There's a huge lore and a world to all of that, but it's not what you're playing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, if you want comic books, like, that's definitely the universe for you.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, it's a lot of buzzwords in there.
There's a lot of bravado in that announcement. Yeah. And I mean, they need something, right? They need to have, like, I feel like if you strip out all the things that make BioWare games worthwhile and make them BioWare games, and you say you're done with that, you're doing something else completely different.
Yeah, why?
You're going to have to speak with big words and, you know, lots of flashing lights to get people to pay attention, because when you strip all of that out, I'm just like, why would I, as a longtime BioWare fan, I'm like, why would I play this and not, I don't know, a game from one of the other very many developers that I know can do a game like this
I mean,
very
it's,
well.
Already. It sounds like we're being harsh, but like BioWare, I mean, you have my undivided attention no matter when you release a new IP. I will definitely want to see what you're doing.
Of course.
Yeah. Just based on their pedigree. But like you said, I mean, it's not broken, right? Like, I think BioWare, they do one thing incredibly well. And to sort of step out of the mold from that, I'm intrigued, but I'm also a little worried.
Well, right? But they've clearly also been taking the time.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, since 2012. Yeah, yeah. They clearly weren't trying to rush this out the door to just get a new IP going. Yeah. So they've probably been working on it to make sure it was right before they revealed this to the world. Yeah.
Knights of the New Republic.
And they've been sliding in this direction little by little for like a long time now, right? You know, with Mass Effect 2, they made a strong, strong move more towards it being an action game and a shooter rather than an RPG. With Dragon Age 2, they tried to make that move and got crucified for it.
You press a button and something awesome happens.
Right.
The quote that, like, we'll never die.
Yeah. It's like, and so they
that was from Dragon Age 2?
That was Dragon Age 2, yeah.
Okay.
They've been making this move little by little. And those are like two examples that didn't, you know, well, Mass Effect 2 worked out really well. Dragon Age 2, not so much. And then, you know, I don't know, they added kind of like a fairly interesting multiplayer mode to Mass Effect 3. You can see the signs. They want to move on from RPG. I mean, the doctors moved on. They left.
Yeah, they're gone.
You know,
they're
so that pedigree, I don't want to say they have no other talent there, but, you know, I think they want to expand into other markets.
Does anyone remember Shadow Realms?
I mean, yes.
A little bit.
Yeah. This was BioWare's asymmetrical multiplayer game that they announced a couple years ago, but then canceled in early 2015.
No, I didn't remember that.
So, okay.
I don't know if some part of that has been reworked into whatever this new thing is.
It would make sense.
But we know, you know, that was at least a multiplayer game that they had announced before.
Well, especially with the move from Mass Effect 3 into a multiplayer space, it certainly seems like.
When was this announced?
2014,
okay.
Around Gamescom and
it would make sense. Like, they put 2 years in development of whatever that tech is going to be, and then realize that's not going to work out. And so they've technically been working on it since 2012.
Yep.
So it could be I don't know how I would feel if the next BioWare game is online only, multiplayer only.
Well, how would you feel if it were free to play?
I'd feel fine.
That's fine. Yeah.
I mean, I've played a million great free to play games.
A million.
Literally 1 million. So. No, as long as there's my big thing is like multiplayer.
I really do.
The multiplayer can mean a lot of things, though. You know, like as long as there is, I would say as long as there's a PvE experience of some kind to have, then there's at least a chance that there's a world and kind of like an experience to go on, a quest to go on, areas to explore. Like, multiplayer doesn't have to mean like, hey, you're in an arena shooting at each other.
Yeah.
It could mean other things, and I hope it means other things, because if I want to just go into an arena and shoot people there, I have so many choices that I do not need BioWare for.
Yeah.
On the flip side, I have so few choices in terms of developers doing what BioWare does right now, and I just don't want to lose that. So call me bitter.
Not going to call you that.
You're Vince.
Everybody's trying to make a game as service.
Yeah.
They don't want to just make a $60 game that you buy once, play for 40 hours, and then put away. They want they want Destiny, Overwatch, a game that you'll just keep playing, and they can keep you as a customer all year long. And this is EA's got to be one of EA and BioWare's plays to do that.
I imagine.
Let's check in with the listeners.
Hey, listeners.
Thank you. Listeners, remember, you can always reach us at the email address gamescoop@ign.com, just like Isaac did. Isaac says, hi, guys.
Hey, Isaac.
I was wondering if any major fighting game lets you create a fighter. Something along the lines of a WWE game. If not, why, and would this be a good feature? Vince?
Okay, so there have been several fighting games that allow you to either create or customize a character for use. So even major ones. I'm trying to think. One of the Soul Calibers, I want to say four. Yep. Wow. Right, yeah. Surprised you knew that. That's
why?
Because it's random.
All right, you know what?
I don't think of you as a good fighting job, game guy.
I was really into Soul Calibur.
And that's what I was gonna say. It's not so much that I'm like, oh, you wouldn't play a fighting game. It's more like Soul Calibur 4 of all the random.
No, I got into Soul Calibur at 2 and then stopped at 5.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah. Soul Calibur 4 had that. There was a kind of more obscure fighter on the PS1 called Tobal Number 2.
Yeah.
Tobal
had 1. A make your fighter maker mode?
You can get, yeah, you have a fighter maker mode. Then there's like actual like fighter maker, which was also for the PS1.
Literally called fighter maker. Yeah. That's so good. So, like, what do we call it? Well, what is it?
I have a story about that game.
Oh, do you?
I think it's, yeah, it was all about designing your own fighters and designing their moves and everything. And I bought the game and I was so excited, but it was only after I got home that I realized that every single one of the fighters you created took up an entire memory card.
Yeah. Wow.
So it's like, it just wasn't, you know, it just didn't make any sense.
It was the same thing with RPG Maker. It was like that. It just took up an entire memory card.
I'm not going to keep like 15 memory cards. Yeah, exactly. My fighters
it's
on.
The most expensive game I've ever bought. Yeah,
exactly.
But I mean, as far as like why it's not done.
I mean, yeah, it's balanced. Well,
I mean, it's all balanced. Exactly. I mean, it would be very difficult to balance something like
but
that.
But imagine a Street Fighter game could have, a multiplayer mode that was just for created fighters, right? And it doesn't need to be used in tournaments or anything.
Right, but when you think about it, and this is what's interesting, you know, Injustice 2 is already playing with this idea of all these different gear slots and then ability modifications. And we already know that that's going to be, like, there's a, when you go play ranked, at least for now, what they're saying, this could change, obviously, by the time the game comes out, but what they're saying now is that you just, when you play ranked, that's just not,
It's just removed.
Yeah, it's just removed.
I mean, For Honor is doing something very similar where the armor that you get changes a couple sliders on each piece of gear. Like, you have faster cooldown on this, or you block more damage on that. Mm. And, like, you put all these together to create your character, your fighter, and then you go into their 4v4 mode, and, like, that all that stuff applies. But when you go into 2v2 or 1v1 duels, like, that is stripped off, and it's just the, you know, bare-bones characters in that. I mean, they could do something like Soul Calibur did, right? Where you create your character and then give it a moveset based on an existing character.
Right. But then at that point, it's like, am I really creating a character? Yeah, is it just cosmetic?
Exactly.
You know, so it's this weird kind of in between. But like at the end of the day, like, you just can't, if you want people who like love fighting games and want to play competitively to play your game, like, there's no way they're going to play a game where, you know, they could lose just because some other guy's been grinding and grinding and grinding and getting the best gear for their character,
or sets his moves to something that are just super cheap, right?
Yeah,
like nothing but long range pokes and
that's your kryptonite, huh?
I've Helix from Soul Calibur.
I thought there was a make your own fighter game for WiiWare, but I couldn't remember the name. Nobody remembers. If anyone remembers that game, or if it was even real, did I dream it? I mean, is this Super Mario Bros. 2?
Giving away ideas.
This is Jell Snelders.
Hey, Jell Snelders.
Hey, Jell Snelders. Great name.
Yeah.
The best name.
He says he's got an idea for a new PlayStation handheld. You guys ready? We're going to pitch this to you. We're on Shark Tank.
Are we Shark Tanking it?
Yeah. All right. Jell says, about a year ago, I bought a PlayStation Vita. I was thinking
Good for you.
I was thinking of how could such a great device... died. The game's library is very limited, and currently nothing is being developed for it.
There you go.
Not nothing, but sure. Developers had to make exclusive releases instead of porting their games to the Vita, since the device is not powerful enough. Recently, I discovered Remote Play, and it surprised me how well it worked. But also, that is compromised by the lack of the L2 R2 buttons. That annoying back touchpad and the useless camera overpriced the Vita unnecessarily. What if Sony launched a handheld with the sole purpose of streaming PS4 games on it? You would, of course, need a proper internet connection for it, but you could play PS4 games in your living room while your girlfriend watches her annoying series. If Sony would release as a gadget for, say, $150 to $200, would you be interested in a handheld that just streams your PS4 games?
Sounds like an NVIDIA Shield for the PS4. Kinda,
yeah.
No.
No, yeah. Sounds like my Vita now, but with two more shoulder buttons.
Yeah.
And not able to play all the awesome games that I play on my Vita,
and not able to take it on the go with you.
No,
I guess.
Yeah, that would.
Yeah, you'd need some sort of.
So you're basically buying a second screen for an existing console.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a Wii U gamepad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would. No, I would not buy the PlayStation Switch.
Sorry,
Jill.
I cannot fund this.
Is that what they say in Shark Tank?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
I just made it up right now. Sorry, you
feel like they have to make a shark pun, probably.
You've been eaten.
No, that's not. No, that's
you've
not,
been eaten.
You've
yeah,
been
that's,
eaten.
Also, let me just say what we're all thinking. We would all watch our girlfriend's TV shows. I think pretty much everyone here.
I unapologetically and unguiltily watch The Bachelor every Monday night.
Nice.
With my wife.
Yeah. Awesome. I watch every show on the CW. I'm their core demographic. So.
Are you the biggest Gilmore Girls fan?
I love that.
Maybe
I love
ever?
That
probably.
Yeah. Gilmore guy.
Oh, yeah.
It's a good podcast.
Someone's Twitter handle is getting updated.
This is Bon Turkington. Getting some really good names today.
Dude, names are too good.
These are not real names.
These are just IGN staffers writing into us. Under
this dude names. Was a guitarist in a 1980s metal band.
Kurt Bajurkington.
Bon.
This is you're laughing at this guy's name.
No,
I love this.
No, your name is fantastic.
Yeah, we have boring.
He says, "Greetings, Damon and Scoopers. I hope you're all having a great week."
It's not a
Damon and the Scoopers is the name of our band.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not good.
Get scooping.
Jam and the Holograms. Damon and the Scoopers.
I don't want to be a scooper. I feel like there's a pejorative sort of association attached with that.
Bon Turkington says, "With a new pair of consoles arriving this year, Switch and Scorpio, I've also been thinking about my favorite games and consoles from the past. I was born in 85 and have been playing games since my grubby pink mitts could fit around an NES controller. Over the years, besides devouring all the latest offerings, I have built up a sizable collection of older consoles and games dating back to the NES era. However, for all the generations represented in my collection, I'm missing anything before that. You frequently like to help new gamers or new collectors who are looking for advice on which games or consoles to begin their journey on. Just the other week, you helped a new Nintendo fan decide where to jump into their catalog of games. But I rarely hear mention of anything before the NES era. Is it worth my time, money, and shelf space to seriously focus on collecting old Atari consoles and others from before I was born? I can see a number of problems with doing so. First of all, the games are arguably harder to enjoy, at least for long periods of time. Mm-hmm. Also, the old hardware is literally falling apart, with some chips, screens, and batteries failing after more than 35 years in existence. Am I better off playing Rare Replay and other collections with older games and focusing my collection on what I have been, or can you really make an argument that the very first consoles are worth owning?"
I personally, as someone whose first console was the Texas Instruments TI-99/4A, it's not worth going back.
I mean,
there's no game that exists on a ColecoVision, an old Atari, the Intellivision, the Odyssey,
that first party system seller for the Atari. Is that what you mean?
Like, none of that stuff. Like, there's not a single game on any of them that there isn't a better version of. And when I say better, I don't mean like modern, super fancy. No, I mean like a cleaner, better playing, better running version of the same exact thing that you can get either through emulation or in some collection somewhere.
I grew up during that time. I played all those old games. But even even when you play some of the games on the NES Classic, you're like, this is like, I like the novelty of revisiting this, but I don't really want to play much of this today.
I actually had that experience.
And it's going back before the NES is you get diminishing returns.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't think you're really like, if you want to like just be a collector, sure, that's by all means, hunt down these old consoles. But don't, I wouldn't recommend it if you actually plan on playing or wanting to play a lot of these games.
I will say there's one exception to all this.
What's that?
If you can find yourself a unit that's working well, definitely it's worth, I think, the experience and to play a Vectrex. The Vector-based graphics, like, you can't, there is no other way to experience that but to buy that system. And the look of it is just so unique and it's kind of space age for not just for the time, even now. Like, I think I was at a PAX. Yeah. I think I was at PAX East maybe 3 years ago, and I went to the retro room, the free play room, and played around with the Vectrex. And the version of Asteroids on there, they had to pull me away. Like, it runs so smooth and it looks so singular and different and clean and unique from anything else that I think that that system is an old experience that's worth having that you can't have anywhere else.
I would agree with that. Actually, Vectrex games are really cool.
Yeah,
but you can find those arcade versions of like Tempest.
Sure.
Super Tempest.
But there's something about the vector-based graphics that just gives them a totally unique look and feel, a level of kind of depth and, like I said, a space-agey feel. I know that doesn't sound very technical, but that I don't think you can get anywhere else.
This is Thomas Embry.
Hey, Thomas.
Oh, sorry.
Says, hi, guys.
Fall asleep with the wheel.
I'm a young lad from Birmingham, England. Hey. And recently, I remembered that I have an EA access code lying about. I redeemed the code and thus realized that there are games you can play for free as long as you are subscribed. I wasn't aware of this, as I thought you could only play trials. There are games for everyone, including RPGs and sports games. For $20 a year, I think this is a great deal, as some of these games on there on their own cost $20 or more. Do you think that developers and publishers should have these kinds of services like Activision, Blizzard, or Bethesda, or do you think they would lose too much money? So the real question is, like, should other publishers have their own sort of subscription programs where you gain access to their game libraries?
I mean, yeah, sure. I have a feeling EA is doing this. EA's access is twofold. One, when sales drop off for games enough, the access subscription sort of makes up for it if that game is going to draw you into subscribing to the program, in addition to, you know, the sneak peek of upcoming games as well. So,
yeah,
I mean, I could see Activision, like, play any Call of Duty whenever you want at any time for $10 a month, you know? I could see them doing something like that because no one's buying World at War anymore. But I don't know. It seems like one of those problems that isn't big enough to really need to make a published mandate for.
Yeah.
I mean, personally, I think that if it's the right publisher with the right library of games and the price is right, it can be a good way to extract extra revenue from games that have stopped selling anyway. Like, you know, I don't know. Like, so for, I know you're just throwing out numbers. Like, I don't know if $10 a month is something I would pay to play any Call of Duty ever, but like, I don't know, maybe like something in that neighborhood. If you found the right number, I mean, like, what's the harm in offering that, right? Like, you're not cannibalizing, you know, you're not hurting the sales of Call of Duty, you know, the original Modern Warfare. I mean,
World
like,
of War.
You know, right. You're not going to hurt those game sales. You can only, that's only extra revenue on games that you already made and have long since stopped selling. So I don't see any reason not to try to pilot a program like that.
Well, the flip side of that is that it has to pay for itself because you need to have the staff and the infrastructure and you need to digitize the games and you need to make them available on the portal. So, I mean, there's considerable overhead that goes into creating a program like that, and would it pay off? Like,
yeah, the initial investment would be tough, right? Because the older games probably weren't made initially in terms of their architecture, like to be easily played digitally, or you know, there's. But for going forward, though, once you develop kind of like a process, like a workflow, all new games going forward could be very easy to make available in that way. And so like when, say, you know, the newest Call of Duty is 10 years old or 8 years old and it's already got those hooks in it.
Yeah.
Sure. Why not? I mean,
from a consumer standpoint, though, is anybody really looking for more services to subscribe to?
I don't want any.
No.
I think it would depend if the marketplace wants that, and I don't know if it necessarily does. Especially when you're getting free games every month from PS Plus or Xbox Live, and now whatever the Switch program will be offering with classic NES and SNES games every month. I don't necessarily know if you need that many services to just split the user base more and more.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. Like, if I'm in the mood to play something, like just something new that I don't care, I have a year and a half of Xbox Live Gold and PS Plus titles that I haven't even touched on a 2 terabyte hard drive that's plugged into my Xbox. But like, if I have an itch to play something from a back catalog, like I'll go buy it for $20 on the Xbox store, or I'll go buy it for $20 on PlayStation Plus. I don't think I would need to subscribe to Activision to get access to, you know, Skate or whatever.
Yeah, that's true.
I think if anything, what like the NES Mini proved though is that for if you have this very singular situation where you have a large back catalog of of great games that are not easy and convenient to play anymore, you could certainly sell a service. I mean, I will just say this: if they can sell NES Minis for $60, then I'm sure they can get. Like, I would legit to not have to have my entire massive collection shipped over here from New York. I would totally pay $10 a month to have access to every single NES and Super NES game ever.
Yeah. Like, Nintendo is totally like maybe the rare exception where their catalog is so rich and impressive that, I'd pay a subscription fee to have access to all of Nintendo's first-party games.
Yeah, for sure. Something like that is much more alluring than pay $10 to play World at War whenever you
want.
On
on a unified console, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Like, I've never played a Monster Hunter game because I'm not a big handheld gamer. Mm-hmm. So I would love the opportunity to play that at a console. Yeah, totally agree with you.
All right, now is the time on Game Scoop when we play video game 20 questions.
Oh, oh boy.
Right.
So we're all coming into this a little nervous.
Don't be nervous.
Because our heavy hitters are gone.
Don't be nervous. Jonathan, this is your first time. Do you
I'm
know
excited.
How this works?
Yes, but okay. If you want to refresh
well,
my
you know,
memory.
You do know how 20 questions work.
Yes,
right?
I do.
Yeah. Well, video game 20 questions is infinitely easier because you already know it's a video game.
It narrows it down.
Person, place, or thing? No, it's a video game.
Fruit.
And you have 20 yes or no questions to guess. This week's suggestion comes from...
Cover.
Chris White.
Hey, Chris White.
Chris White emailed in this week's suggestion. Hey, let the questioning begin.
Okay, so I'll just lead us off with the old faithful. Was this game released before January 1st, 2000?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm blanking on what the narrowing down question.
So usually once we know that then usually we'll start either we'll narrow the time down further by like seeing if it was in the 90s or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So was it released after January 1st, 1990?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so now we have a window.
Was it released on the PlayStation platform?
No.
Okay, so just to clear up everything else then, was this a platform exclusive game?
Yes.
Okay.
So
what do we got?
So we're talking, we're in the 90s.
Yeah.
And
we are in the 90s.
So we're in the 90s and it's not a Sony platform. So like the thing is, the 90s is this overlap time where
yeah, that's tough.
Like early 90s, there's still a couple of NES games coming out, but like not that many. It's mostly Super Nintendo at this point.
16-bit, yeah.
Yeah, it's really Super Nintendo. And then then you get into the N64 as well if you're talking on Nintendo.
Yeah.
And Sega is... the Genesis.
Yeah, you have the Genesis
and the Saturn, and the Dreamcast are all in that.
Do we want to waste a question on
Dreamcast and Saturn were discs. Genesis, SNES, 64 were cartridges. I think that's a waste of a question.
So we know it's a disc split isn't the way to go.
Right. No, it's so. But we know it's
strategizing.
We know it's a console. We know it's a platform exclusive though. So, I would continue narrowing down the platform.
Yeah.
That's you. It's your question, though.
Did this game come out on the Nintendo 64?
No.
Okay. Might as well just clear it up then.
Yeah.
Did this come out on any Nintendo platform?
No.
Okay.
Okay. So,
is Dreamcast or the Genesis?
So, right. So, was this on a Sega platform?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I could clear it up. I wish you had just said, was it on the Dreamcast? Because then it would be the Genesis.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would have been...
We can have that back, right?
No.
okay.
No, because it could have been the Saturn as well.
That's true.
Could have been the Saturn.
That's true. Okay. Was it on the... you said Dreamcast?
It's Dreamcast, Saturn, or Genesis, yeah.
Oh, but you said Sega. Okay.
Yeah.
Was this game on the Dreamcast?
No.
No. Okay, so.
Safe to assume it was the Genesis.
Genesis. Do we want to operate on that?
I mean, we've burned all these questions on that.
Yeah, we've burned quite a bit.
We should get the platform, yeah.
Do you play as a human in this game?
No.
Okay.
Okay. Is the primary mode of interaction shooting?
No, that's 10.
Okay.
So not human,
mm-hmm.
not shooting.
I'm thinking platformer. It's the Lion King. It's got
you can ask if it's a Disney, because there are multiple Disney platformers.
Though. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I feel like, is it a platformer? Is it better?
Yeah.
If you want to.
Yeah. Is it a platformer?
No.
Well, it's not Lion King.
Okay. All right. knocks out a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. What do we want to go for then?
A game where you don't
play as a human. It's not a platformer, and you're not shooting is the primary way of play.
Echo the Dolphin.
Is that in any way considered a platformer?
I don't know.
No, definitely.
No. Yeah,
definitely not. Yeah,
it's an exploration game.
It's worth a shot.
I don't want to get into the
does
genre.
This game take place
in genre game.
Does this game take place underwater?
Yes.
Jeez, yeah, are you a dolphin?
Yes.
Is it Echo the Dolphin?
Yes.
Got it.
Echo the Dolphin.
Yes.
All right.
There you go.
Right there.
See, you got it. So you're so.
And one for the host.
Yeah. You're so unconfident going into this.
Yeah.
Got it. Echo the Dolphin. 1992. One thing that might have tripped you up is that Sega did not develop that game. They only published it. It was developed by a developer known as Novo Trade.
Never even heard of him.
Yeah,
exactly. I forgot about that.
Action adventure, I think, is the genre.
Yeah, it makes sense.
That's fair.
Single player game.
That's the catch-all genre for anything
exactly.
That we don't know exactly what it is.
Is there action? Is there adventure?
Well, at Game of the Year voting, it's like, is this more of an action game? Is it an adventure game? Or is it an action-adventure game? I'm like, you know what? I don't want to be here anymore.
You know
anymore.
What? If it's a sandbox game, it's action-adventure. Get it out of here.
Exactly.
But I actually don't remember like if Echo shot anything. I was guessing.
I thought he shot bubbles sonar or something.
Yeah. Shooting would be like implied like a project. He could fire out like kind of like a generalized.
He didn't shoot. He fired.
Sonar.
Sonar.
He screeched.
Sound. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I don't think I was misleading you.
No.
Nicely done. And thank you for the suggestion. Who sent in that suggestion again? That was
Chris White. Yeah.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks, Chris.
Really, thank you, Chris.
Yes, thank you.
Seriously.
Well played.
Yeah.
You're
right in my wheelhouse.
I feel less embarrassed for my first time. Yeah.
Justin and Sam, they're going to get to enjoy your win.
Yeah.
It's a group win.
Yes.
Oh, good.
So they
good.
The win gets
happy to help.
We took it home for the team.
It's a team thing.
All right, I think that's all the scoops we have for you this week. Remember, you can always reach us at the email address, gamescoop@ign.com. Thank you, Vince. Thank you, Brandon. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
My name is Damon. This is IGN Gamescoop.
Later, folks.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.